So I'll talk about multi-scale analysis for intense atmospheric vortices. And this is joint work in the bulk of the lecture with Eileen Mikuski, who did her PhD defense on February 6th. I'm very happy she did very well. With Gunther Karke and Anthony Owino, who are with me at the Potsdam Institute and the Freie Universität in Berlin. And then the last part of the lecture, I will briefly speak about the multi-scale model that currently Andy and I are discussing, and that he has already mentioned, he told me, during the last 2 days. Here's the schedule, motivation, modeling approach, scalings, structural motion of a moist vortex, then scale interactions, and then the multi-scale model that I mentioned. Here's the motivation. So we want to look at concentrated vortices such as hurricanes, and we will look at a regime of the weaker ones, the H1, H2 kind of hurricanes, where the velocities are not humongous, but considerable, and the scales, length scales, are in the range of 200-250 kilometers. These hurricanes, I took this from the web, they move over, this is these dots that you see here is positions of basically the center of the hurricane in intervals of 6 hour or 12 hour. Here, up here it's 12 hour intervals and the other the 6 hour intervals. And if you check such a curve the vortex makes over a time scale of a day or two. So this is supposed to be our characteristic time scale. We want to study the motion, we want to try to get reduced equations for the vortex core dynamics and the vortex motion on these effectively synoptic timescales. We want to follow the large scale motion of the vortex. And I will, as I said earlier, briefly go into multiscales even with inside the vortex core. We already have a multiscale problem because we want to embed this concentrated vortex in a synoptic scale environment. So that's already multi-scale. But there is, this is of the type of boundary layer asymptotics, whereas there is also some inherent multi-scaling, of course, inside of the structure. The modeling approach that I will, that we're using basically goes as follows. We have this ambition of treating meteorological models across the board from boundary layer theories all the way to planetary in one and the same framework. And mathematically speaking, what you need in order to do scaling analysis and asymptotic limits, you need a small parameter. Now, if you want to do from boundary layers all the way up to planetary in the same kind of approach, you want one small parameter that doesn't depend on the phenomenon you're looking at. And that small parameter is there. It is the ratio of the centripetal acceleration due to Earth rotation at the equator, divided by the acceleration of gravity. It also turns out that the sound speed at the sound speed and the circumferential velocity due to Earth rotation are roughly comparable, which as a consequence has it that when you combine the two parameters, you come up with this aspect ratio of the Earth scale, pressure scale height divided by the Earth radius, and that is a small parameter that I call epsilon cubed. That epsilon is going to be my small parameter here. Turns out that even in 1951, Joe Keller and Lu Ting wrote a note that was an internal technical note at what became the Courant Institute later on. It is now in tech and nice print available through this archive, web archive. And they already suggested when they looked at planetary flows to use that kind of small parameter to do their analysis. I go a step further and I want to now start off from Earth the radius of the Earth or the planetary scale is the pressure scale height divided by epsilon cubed. Now I can access systematically smaller scales by different powers of epsilon in here, so that the synoptic scale turns out to be h scale over epsilon squared. When you use that scaling, you actually get quasi-geostrophic theory. And if you go to the mesoscales, you have h scale over epsilon. If you have epsilon to the power 0 down here, you are at basically the scale where you would derive unelastic models in the classical sense. So what we then do is, in terms of that epsilon, we do multiple scales asymptotic ansatzes, where t and x and z are non-dimensionalized by the scale height and the characteristic advection time across the scale height. And then you can dab into different lengths and time scales by scalings of the coordinates with epsilon. And it turns out, and this is what basically justifies the whole approach after the fact, that by if you specialize this ansatz and pick a single time, a single horizontal, and a single vertical coordinate out of the whole zoo, you end up with different, very well established classical models that you find in textbooks. And all of these models are then derived using that kind of asymptotic ansatz and sticking it into the fully compressible 3D flow equations, and in the current look I can get those models, which is very nice. Of course, the basics of it is multiscaling. The basic idea behind it is multiscale, and so now let's look at some multiscale problems in the context of what we have here, the concentrated vortex. The scalings here are taken for what Europeans would call the Lothar storm or H1 hurricanes. It could, very strong storms, concentrated storms in the mid-latitudes would also fall into this regime. But here, probably the H1s or H2 hurricanes are more of it. So we want to scale our horizontal coordinates so that we can, on the one hand, resolve the core of the vortex, which is on the 200 kilometer scale, say, but also we want the large environment described. So we have to dab into what is called the synoptic scale, and we do that by two different scalings of the horizontal coordinate in powers of epsilon. And this will be a boundary layer type analysis so that we have a synoptic, basically geostrophic environmental flow, and inside of that we embed in a boundary layer type the internal core structure of the vortex.
What limits you to H1? I mean, the principle H over A is very small.
This, it turns out.
So what's the limit on that limit speed, the swirl speed? Why is that?
We don't have to, of course, but when you rescale the velocities with a different power of epsilon, you go out of the gradient wind balance regime. This is the regime, as it turns out, that gives you gradient wind balance, which was for us sort of the classical regime where you get these vortices that are beyond geostrophic balance.
But
if you go to even faster velocities, then there is an inner core where you have I don't know what the meteorological term is, where they basically have a fluid vortex balance.
Well, but it's still, I mean, even H5 or hurricanes are gradient
well.
Well,
they
do
in the
degree except for boundary layer, so.
Like what he's talking about, just due to the cyclostrophic gradient balance.
Yeah, that's right.
But hang on now, I mean, gradient balance includes cyclostrophic balance. So if
your
target
is a different regime,
H5 should be in this.
Asymptotically, it's a different regime. You go to one faster in the velocities, you see at leading order a balance of the radial pressure gradient and the centripetal acceleration from the circumferential flow, and the Coriolis comes in as a higher order perturbation. This is the regime where they all match in one and the same.
It just doesn't seem plausible. I mean, use a different model to study H1 hurricanes. H4.
I'm just being honest.
I think there's a cultural difference here. People who do applied math asymptotics are very conservative in their statements. It doesn't mean that you couldn't apply this conclusions of the statements to bigger regimes. And I think, Rupert, you're being conservative and honest in our usual applied math way, which is good. But you can probably apply your scale up your results.
We would like to try it out, of course. But it might be interesting.
I was just asking
to look
at there's a fundamental barrier, or if it's going to be conservative, that's all.
The techniques could be applied to these other regimes, of course. Good, so this is what we have here. Then the outer expansion for the surrounding flow has epsilon squared x, as I mentioned before, that resolves the synoptic scale, and associated with that is epsilon squared t, which is the advection time scale over that distance. And for the core region, we have a slightly rescaled inner horizontal coordinate, We keep the time scaling, so what we are after here is the slow time core evolution over synoptic times, whereas the vortex travels along. We expect, in fact, from looking at those tracks of the hurricanes, which only once in a while have a kink with a strong change, that more rapid changes than those would happen only once in a while, but not systematically as the thing travels along and makes a big curve. So we look at a quasi-steady evolution of the vortex core. We want to describe big displacements, or displacements on that synoptic scale distance, which means that we have to expand the horizontal coordinate by looking at deviations from a center position, which is indicated by this line here, and that center position has a 1 over epsilon squared scaling in it, so that can actually bridge large distances. And then we move on and basically want to study first the inner core equations and then match them to the surrounding flow solutions. What we systematically get in that sequence is, first we get leading axisymmetric balances. It's going to be Eliasson type balanced vortex models with slight modifications. When we look at the first order Fourier modes and match the solution to the surroundings, I'll get to more details of that later on, we find equations for the center line motion and the tilt of the vortex as a function of the core structure and the background shear. And when we go to second order axisymmetric balances and then look at solvability conditions over long times, we get core structure evolution equations. That's always the pattern that comes in these concentrated vortex analyses. So here's a discussion of structure and vortex, and I will have a couple of slides on structure and then a couple of slides on motion. So we start with structure. We of course get unelastic hydrostatic at the leading orders. We have to have a homentropic background, as it turns out, because what we want is that the deep convection is possible. And in the scalings that I worked out with Andy in a recent paper, you capture the moist adiabatic stratification by having the potential temperature scale as 1 plus epsilon squared plus a vertical stratification. This comes out as a quasi-natural scaling for this, and this is also the scaling that we that I use to re-derive the quasi-geostrophic theory. So we are in the right ballpark here. And it is, by the way, also, of course, true for all the derivations of the anelastic models, like Ouma, Phillips, etc. So then at the circumferential momentum balance, we find quickly that the leading order structure is axisymmetric. We find gradient wind balance as it should be. This is what basically dictated the scalings. And then we have this transport equation along stream surfaces of the total angular momentum. That's also well known. You suck in the planetary vorticity from distances. You bring it in, it spins up the vortex, the air moves upwards, and as it goes out, it slows down again, or even starts rotating backward if it's pushed out too far. So all of this is not surprising and pretty well known. Here comes an equation that I would like to discuss a little. It's a transport equation for potential temperature. And basically, potential temperature should be carried along streamlines and then have a source term if there is adiabatic heating.
Why did you choose theta as your adiabatic invariant when it's perfectly nice moist adiabatic invariant?
That is true. That is more a cultural part. I was used to doing that from combustion analyses, but of course, actually in recent work on boundary layers with Björn, who convinced us that we should change to other convergent entities, but of course it can go back and forth.
Yeah. I should see their expansion for theta E, it's really fun.
Does that make me more comfortable, or does that make me...
No, it's nice, actually. Okay. But they use Terry's theta E, essentially, we use for your book, and then do the expansion. It's quite fun.
Reversible.
At the leading order for the potential temperature equation, we actually get this. vertical velocity times stratification of entropy times the latent heat release that we could get from vertical motions because we move through a saturation field is zero. So the consequence is either that we have W equal to zero or that we have the bracket equal to zero, which means we are on a Moise radial line. That would be expected. So this is what we adopt in order to be allowed to have parcels move vertically over the entire scale height. There's a catch here, and we'll get back to that later on, because if you look at the details of those bulk microphysics closures, you find that if a parcel moves, in fact, the entire distance vertically, you should expect a lot of precipitation, of course. When the precipitation has been falling out of the parcel, this guy comes with a sign constraint. So the positive sign is easy. You can move it up, and the thermodynamics goes along a Moise adiabat, but if you want to move it back down, there's nothing you can evaporate, and then you have a danger. You are more or less stuck unless something happens. And I will discuss that later on a little bit. At the next order, we then get a transport equation for the third order potential temperature, which turns out to be the potential temperature order of magnitude that is also relevant for the geostrophically balanced outer flow. So this is the variable that actually matches to the outer flow in potential temperature. And then you have fluctuation terms here that could capture whatever you have. Perturbations of the latent heat, of course, from perturbations of the thermodynamics, but you could also have radiation or whatever come in here. We have it lumped together as a lumped term just to see what it can do. Importantly, I think, this is an order up. I have it here, yes. This term is one order higher than the latent heat release from the scale vortex scale motions. So it is actually small perturbations of the diabatic heats superimposed over the bulk of what you get from the upward motion that determines the vortex structure. So we have that summarized here in those equations. This is a quasi-steady Elias and Tai balanced model. I say quasi-steady because normally in the transport equation for total angular momentum and in the potential temperature equation, you would have a ddt term in here in the original version of the model. By our time scalings, that doesn't occur. Of course, we can do multiple times and include it again. This is what my student Patrick, who is in the back of the audience, is supposed to work on, and Will is currently working on. But here in this model, we don't have that in there. We look at quasi-steady evolutions. If you cross out the L and the K, it's basically the classical Eliasson model without the time derivatives, except that in this term here, what he originally had was the equation one order up, and the source term was the lump term that included the scaled latent heat release. So we have
subtraction. That remark there, you said it's the Eliasson model without time derivatives,
yeah.
But the Eliasson model is derived on the basis there are time derivatives.
It's
trivial in the steady state problem.
Yeah. Well, these equations are not quite trivial.
No, but I'm not quite sure what the base of that remark was.
Well, if think of it as Eliasson's model, I think it was derived originally to describe how the waves could be.
You take the time derivative of the thermal wind equation, and then you eliminate time derivatives from the tangential wind equation or from the thermodynamic equation. But if the time derivatives are, if it's a steady problem, then you can't produce a Soyer-Eliasson equation.
Oh, but this is the analog of it for the steady case. And if you go to his scaling arguments, it turns out that the equations, when you go step by step through the momentum equations and through the circumferential and potential temperature transport equations, and you look at what is his assumptions on the scalings, you find these equations with time derivatives here. And then if you go step further to eliminate everything and go down to one scalar quantity, then you come up with this classical equation. And so this is the analog of those equations for the steady state. You could think of it as wait until Eliasson's equations have approached this and have produced a steady state. It's very important.
one little piece about one point. Are you assuming axial symmetry from the beginning, because, or are you allowing some of the higher order corrections to be non-axial symmetric?
That will come.
Okay.
It's very important.
Because the third order potential temperature looks like it's still axial.
This is still axial symmetric, that's good, but the next order is going to, and in fact it's crucial for the whole thing when we talk about vortex motion.
Right.
Yeah. Right, so it turns out when you, these terms, I haven't written them down in detail, these terms come in regimes that I'm not discussing here today, when the vortex tilt is large enough to have the bottom and the top differ by roughly one radius of the vortex. So the tilt is relatively large. And if you allow for relatively large vertical velocities, in terms of our powers of epsilon, we have studied a dry case and a moist case. In the moist case, we have epsilon squared vertical velocities. In the dry case, they are constrained by stability, and then we have one order down in magnitude. If you have both tilt and large vertical velocities, you actually get non-trivial corrections from exactly the asymmetric motions, non-linearities from the asymmetric motion. So here is a point that I was announcing already. I mentioned that there is this difficulty of the air having a hard time coming back down after it has risen. If you go back to this equation for a moment, this equation just tells us that along streamlines, the total angular momentum is conserved when the k is not there, which is what we assume now. So along the streamline, m is conserved. If you simply think of the latent heat release near the eye of the vortex, just by the upward motion, as being the latent heat, the heating of the vortex, then the streamlines would look like that. They would go up here and spread out. Now, if m is conserved on such a surface, you can immediately see when the radius becomes large and Parsons move out and out and out, then the u theta has to be proportional to the radius itself in order to make the conservation happen. So that basically you get this problem, you nicely spin around this way in the vortex core because you have pulled in the planetary vorticity. But then when you go up here and move outwards and you cannot have the air come back down, it starts rotating backwards and it behaves like a solid body rotation in the far field. That doesn't seem to be what's happening. The question is, what then? So then what we said next is, what can we say something about the far field? If we go out here in our asymptotics and look at the large distance behavior of the core equations, we can actually say something, assuming that the vortex has total circulation. Now, Mike is going to jump at me and say that they probably don't. But if you assume the vortex to have total circulation, it has a 1 over r velocity dependence in the distance. And then you can actually analytically derive that equation down here. For large distances, if you move vertically by velocity w0, you are moving into layers with different, potentially different circulation. So, and you should assume a vertical stratification of the circulation because these guys move one way in the bottom and the other way on the top. So gamma, the circulation is a function of z, so this d gamma dz is non-trivial. So if you move vertically, you are moving into layers with different total circulation. You can do so only if you take planetary vorticity and take it along so that it matches with the circulation that you see. This is what this equation says. You radially transport planetary rotation, and then you're allowed to move through the levels of different circulation. What that means, however, is if the gamma, the velocity ur behaves as 1 over r at large distances, you will find analytically that these string surfaces become vertically asymptotically at large distances. So there is no such thing as a string surface going in and coming out and then moving forever in the horizontal. It's not possible. At least in these equations, I don't see how it works.
Traditionally, there are two ways around that. One, of course, is to put cooling in the system. I think you're going to talk about. The other is to recognize that in any real case, the actual time it takes to establish that flow in a time-dependent solution is so long that you consider it to be quasi-steady, but it's not. It never In other words, you can maintain the time dependence. But if you really want a steady state, then you have a problem. I mean, I think in the real world, the time it takes to establish that things like them is so long that it never enters as an important constraint.
So that would mean we would have to include a shorter time scale in order to see that. That could be an option.
What about the non-uniformity in omega and the condition of matching to an outer flow eventually?
Non-uniformity in
omega,
what is omega?
The rotation,
yes,
vector is changing as a function of position on the globe. So you have,
yeah,
you have to match to that, which,
yeah,
which is an order R term out there also. And secondly, just the condition that you have to match to outer flow conditions might automatically bring in these symmetries at a higher level.
Well, they don't. The matching, basically, the planetary rotation is a function of the latitude. You see that in the on the quasi-geostrophic level as a data effect. That you can see.
You're taking R to infinity, so you've got to take that into account at this level because R.
No. I mean, the equations dictate what I have to measure or not. So what I have to do is I have to look at the inner and core equations and their behavior at large R, and I have to match that to the behavior of the outer solutions as R goes to zero. That has to be systematically matched. And at that level of the analysis, it doesn't help me.
Where does friction come in?
At this stage, there is no friction. So this would be one question. Is there enough friction to make things happen?
I think you can't necessarily pull the picture you drew of these lines of constant absolute angular momentum. You can't necessarily pull flowing from a large distance like that, because if you try and pull it in with a finite force, you pull it in when it has a certain radial displacement, then the centrifugal force is so big that it opposes the.
Yeah, but that's in the gradient wind balance. It's in there. That is all covered.
But then you wouldn't have streamlines coming in like that, would you?
But basically, the argument that I was making for parcels going out works the same way for parcels going in.
Right.
So if you want to wait infinitely long, you pull in more and more.
No, but what I'm suggesting is that you wouldn't do that, because you would only have a finite force.
I agree with you. So this is why I'm making that case. I mean, the equations, I can play with them, and I can say, let me look at what the structure of the solstrom's in theta are. So if the solstrom is, like, assumed in some papers that have studied numerically what happens in intense vortices, if you assume the solstrom's to be positive only and concentrated near the core, this is what you get in terms of streamlines. If, however, some way you have their diabatic terms that also have a negative branch further outside, you can make the air come back down and you get a closed circulation, like I've indicated here, in which case all those contradictions don't turn up with the matching in the far field.
I think what has us a little confused is that, to put it in this framework, is that your thermodynamic sources have already entered this order, right, if you consider those to be latent heating.
Yeah.
But your sources and sinks of angular momentum apparently have not entered at this order. And yet, in the full system, those are comparable in magnitude, right, in some normalized sense. You see what I'm saying?
For the
in other words, you're evoking conservation of angular momentum at this order. Presumably
yes,
you
right.
will access at some higher order.
Yes.
But you're not evoking conservation of potential temperature at this order. You're allowing for there to be sources. Whereas I think naturally one would suppose that the angular momentum sinks, the torques, the frictional torques,
mm-hmm.
and the diabatic sources would enter at the same order. I think that's what has us
right.
all.
Actually, I'd like to discuss that in some, maybe over coffee breaks or so, in some to some extent, because what I'm constructing here, if you go back to this equation, consistently I'm having at the leading order, I'm excluding friction.
Yes, I know. Right?
And then at the next order, it turns out that only at the next order I see, because only in the theta equation do I have to go to the next order.
But that's his point.
So that this is the scaled, latent heat release just because of the moist adiabatic motion. So it has nothing to do with small scale effects or anything, or which would cause at the same time friction as the solstrom comes up. This is from the scaled motions.
Okay, so so
consistently,
say
I would say that I have to include momentum.
Yeah, so the order. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. So it's a moist adiabatic and frictionless.
Okay.
At that leading one, that's right. And interestingly, only in the theta equation does the small scale stuff come in a natural way in order to have a closed system.
Mm.
Right, okay, fine. Next was here. Right. So then there's this question, if you have precipitated out all the water moving up in the upward branch, can you ever come back down? I have no final answer. I have a hypothesis which I would like to bounce off of you, we'll see what you say. Before I do that, let me summarize. I've discussed quasi-Stanley-Eliasson type balance models at basically leading order. On scale, vortex scale latent heat release, basically is there only to unfreeze the motion from the background stability. Higher order diabatics participate in determining the vortex core structure. Now, that latent heat release, quotes the backward version of it, the condensation heat is not available in a scaled motion on the downward branch because you lose all the droplets to evaporate. And now, I have to jump or promise that I come back to that at the end, because what I want to do next is discuss quickly how we get to the motion and what the asymmetric parts of the vortex tell us about that. The idea for getting to the vortex motion is as follows. You study, in fact, first of all, in the axisymmetric polar coordinates, a constant vector has this representation. Right? So that the first Fourier modes in the circumferential direction should participate in generating a mean flow. And in fact, what we do is we first study the first order perturbations, the first Fourier modes, in the next order equations, and then we derive from what is the behavior of these solutions in the far field. And we seek four constants times the cosine theta ER sine theta E theta. If we find those, it means that the vortex induces in its far field, say, a velocity backwards in this direction. Now, if you want to systematically embed it in a surrounding flow that has its own geostrophic background, then you have to move the vortex forward because it has to match the velocity of the far field. Right? So it's pushing itself backwards like a swimmer. This is the picture. So if you add that on top of the background flow, you in fact get a motion that's non-trivially affected by the vortex core structure itself. It's a superposition of the background that carries it, just like advection, plus a self-induced motion that has to do with the vortex core structure. And in fact, if you go through the analysis, what you find is there's some linear operator acting on all our unknown variables at the next order. It includes subscale heating, which we have introduced as this lump parameter. It includes a weak vortex tilt, and it includes, from the Coriolis force, the vortex motion itself. All these terms enter in the asymmetric perturbation equations at the next order. Now,
is this a balance equation? Are these tilt modes and the vortex motion that's induced by the tilt modes, are they slow, or do you also contain that gravity inertia wave component to this operator L? Is L slow or is L complete in the sense that it's complete?
No, it's slow.
It's slow.
We have the same cascade. So basically, your vortex Rossby waves have done their job and everything is established. That's the picture.
So L implicitly contains the vortex Rossby wave, but it filters the gravity inertia wave.
Is that
right?
No, the vortex Rossby waves, it should should still have filtered, because we look at a balanced state that evolves on the synoptic time scale. And if I, if
tilt
I,
modes are
if I remember correctly, the
tilt modes are Wharton Trotsky waves.
Now, wait a second.
The Wharton Trotsky waves are that's the mathematical, geophysical, fluid dynamic wave describing the precession of the vortex and its dance.
Oh, well, then it's
so it must be
then
in.
It's in. Okay.
You may be talking about the steady state limit, which would be the stationary solution.
So the dry case, we actually get that precession. Anyway, good. So we have a linear operator that is driven by three contributions here. So we go through the analysis of that. It turns out you basically can derive analytically the expressions for the first Fourier modes of the horizontal motion. And you get an equation for the far field when you match it, that the far field velocity that the geostrophic background flow induces at the position of the vortex has to match the self-induced velocity that you see when you go from the core to its own far field. And it is a superposition of some possibly z-dependent, vertically dependent background flow, a subscalating effect with a term that we know explicitly. It includes all the vortex core structure, a vortex tilt expression, and then from the Coriolis terms, another effect of the vortex motion on itself. Now, this equation contains information in two aspects. The leading order vortex velocity should be independent of the vertical direction, because if it wasn't, on the timescales we're looking at, the vortex would be sheared apart over distances much larger than its core, which we exclude. So the leading order the vortex should stay compact, such that the leading order velocity VC0 here that we have should not depend on Z. The other terms do depend on Z, however, in a non-trivial fashion. And we have one quantity that isn't determined yet, namely the X center at this perturbation order, the tilt, which is undetermined. So basically, the tilt has to adjust in such a way that the Z dependence of this whole agglomeration goes away.
Yeah.
So you establish the tilt so that the displacement of the vortex structure makes for a self-induced motion that counteracts the shear.
Which can presumably only happen in certain parameter ranges. The shear is too strong, there's no tilt that will satisfy that.
That is probably true. We haven't gone that far yet to analyze the details of that. So this gives us a tilt. And once we have that tilt, then the sum of the terms actually gives us the motion of the vortex. And it includes, non-trivially, all the core structure. Let me just give you the essence of this term here. The essence of this term is quite interesting. It is like a dz of 1 over rho 0 actually contain rho 0 w some perturbation order k. This is either the cosine or the sine mode, or this is spread by s or c, times u theta plus r omega 0, and that whole thing integrated from 0 to infinity dr. So what it basically is the asymmetric vertical transport of angular momentum. When you think about what it does is, on one side of the vortex, it heaves up the large rotation from the bottom, making a stronger motion in this direction. On the other side, where the velocity is the other way around, it pulls down the weaker rotation from the bottom, so it slows down the flow, which is also a vector pointing in this direction. So this pushes the vortex along. And this here is actually proportional to the tilt. The asymmetric velocity perturbations in the vertical are proportional to the tilt, and this is why this guy.
What happens when the swirl speed is barotropic?
The swirl speed is barotropic.
The argument you just gave assumes that then it's a barotonic vortex.
It
can't work barotropic.
It probably goes away. I have to look at the detail. I can't see it from this point of
view. By disease.
This guy could still depend via x, via the center position. It could still have a z derivative.
Does this predict now the distribution of vertical velocity in the observation in the correct sense? It seems to me it predicts how the vertical velocity perturbations are oriented with respect to the shear vector.
That's right. Yes, that's
what,
right.
What it qualitatively
would be. What we have done, we're right in the stage of going through the details and solving the equations actually, but what we could find for the dry case, an analytical solution which shows the kind of precession that Mike simulated.
Mm-hmm.
So that at least is an indication that we get something that is in par or in line with what seems to be known about this.
I mean, would we, the audience, are engaging in a conversation of trying to recognize the things we know in your asymptotic framework. At this stage, I would look first for steering flow and beta. The steering flow is obvious here, that's your background flow. Where is beta?
The steering flow is not the background flow.
Oh, well then where are your steering flows and betas, which are what mostly control?
We have been trying to sort of
vortex
pin motion. Down what would the steering flow be here, but we couldn't pinpoint it because the formulas we get involve the entire structure of the vortex and the self-induced motion.
I'm using meteorological jargon.
I know.
The steering flow is a vertical angle problem.
I think of this as just the interaction of a baryonic vortex with a shear flow on an F-plane, because omega isn't varying spatially in its framework.
Background flow helps govern the motion,
and the
beta
effect
helps govern the motion, and where's beta?
Beta effect, I haven't mentioned it here. What we have is, there's a paper by Resnick on a barotropic vortex, where he looks at the beta effect. And what he finds is that when you include it, the potential vortex flow that you see on the synoptic scale in the vicinity of a point vortex, that produces a self-induced dipole in interaction with the beta effector that in addition pushes the vortex forward. So, and for completely analogous term, we get it here, so that what you would have is formally another V residual, as he calls it, that is also depending on
so somehow in
because
your expansion
of that.
You have pushed that to a different order.
No, it's not. We can completely it would naturally be included. I've just left it out because the catch here is when you look at the equations for this residual flow from the beta effect, they're very complicated. I don't know whether we can solve them and what the structure is. So this will need more analysis. This is why I'm restricted here to the case where I'm on safe grounds. But in the same solution ansatz, we have the beta effect included. All right. So that summarizes the results or the statements that we can make on the motion and the interaction of the vortex core with the motion. How am I doing in time? Sure.
12 minutes, I think.
Hmm?
12 minutes left.
12? Oh, that's good. It's easy.
12
right.
Includes your questions, but... 12 minutes includes your questions, but...
There weren't any questions.
We're taking care of that's right. We're doing that.
Oh, so I have 2 minutes.
You're the ultimate boss.
One last question about your previous slides. Does it satisfy Galilean invariance? It's not obvious.
Okay, now I talked about this air not coming down, or maybe coming down. I think there is a need to have it come down, otherwise we have this far-field contradiction in the asymptotics. So what I thought is the following. As I mentioned before, it's higher order perturbations of the solstroms that make the vortex core participate in determining the vortex core structure, but the leading order heat release that you get in the upward motions, you can't get it on the downward motion.
Which horizontal length scale do you want to get it down on?
So currently what my hypothesis is, because I get the contradiction coming from the vortex scale going to the far field, its own far field, so it's all within the gradient wind regime where I want to get
it. So you
want to
get it back down on the vortex scale.
That's right. This is currently what I'm looking at. Because when I go to the synoptic scale and allow it to come down there, in the time independent or the quasi-steady picture that I have right now, I have this huge backward rotation coming up.
But that probably that's what's happening.
But wait a second. As you say that, I have more time on the synoptic scale to have things change. The outward motion has to then is then allowed to travel synoptic distances, and so I can. So currently, anyway, I'm thinking of it coming down on the vortex scale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right, so what does it look like? The hypothesis is the following. I've looked at the Clausius-Clapeyron relation, which, where did I write this? I didn't. Which tells me that the amount of water vapor that the air can hold depends sensitively on temperature. So if I have a relatively small temperature difference between the bottom air and the top air, coming from bottom heating and radiation cooling from the top, I get a small difference, or actually by a factor of 1 over epsilon larger difference in the saturation value of the water vapor, of the air. Which could mean that if I send in the spiral band that you always see in this cloud layer, region where you still have strong clouds, if I send upward by unstable convection air that carries water and precipitates out, I can move down with that same amount of water more air than I'm sending upwards. Because the air that's coming down is slightly cooler and therefore has less of a capacity to pick up evaporating water from the rainfall. So that in fact I could have a net mass flux down due to the fact that the temperatures differ slightly and I can overcome this barrier in the stratification that I was missing.
So wait, are you thinking of using the water that you lost by rain on the way back down, because you're coming back down through the rain shaft, so you're getting the evaporation from the rainfall.
Yeah.
So in a way, you're not using the water; you're kind of getting it back.
I'm getting it back, but I'm losing it in the down upward branches, and I'm getting it back in the down.
But that's a tiny difference. I mean, because the temperature difference is very small. So compared to radiative cooling itself, which is going on in the outer region, I would expect that to be a pretty small contribution.
But what is the outer region?
But this
is
not descending back.
About a degree and a half per day. And you see, the thing is, because you're in circular geometry, you can have very weak velocities carrying a very large mass flux compared to the core. So, you know, a centimeter per second over a few hundred kilometers will balance the inner core meter per second if you have gone up. So, radiative cooling, I think, is sufficient to do it if you have a large amount of
area. If I include a larger outer layer.
Well, it doesn't have to be that large, but
it would be in a different regime. Yes.
Yeah, because you've got the R squared effect, so it doesn't have to be that large.
Anyway, so what I was thinking here, just to summarize that picture, is that I can have interleaved upward updrafts and downdrafts, where the resistance for the air that wants to go down due to the stratification is overcome by evaporation from air that I get from precipitation, and I have a net downflux because of the temperature difference. The order of magnitude of the differences, I'd like to talk to you about.
So let us know that net length of heat release.
There is no latent heat release in the branch that where the air comes down. Or it is as much, basically, as you have it in the air that comes outside. This is what it is.
But you need to have rain falling out.
Yeah.
strong.
The latent heat.
If I understand correctly, you have precipitation, if this is the center of the vortex and you go out, there is more precipitation here, and then it becomes much weaker outside.
It's true.
Now, where is the clouds? The clouds stretch a large layer over here.
It's true that the precipitation efficiency of the outer bands is not anything like the cores, but it's not zero either.
Well, then,
Look at
order of magnitude.
You're looking for an effect that's a very small difference between the net source and updrafts and the outer bands and the net sink.
I'd like to look at the noise.
My intuition is that that's going to be very small compared to the radiation.
Good, so anyway, this is what I wanted to say, and it brings me to some other point that I wanted to make, which is that a description of these of the narrow updrafts and downdrafts. I'll make it in 3 minutes. this is, I mentioned earlier, I've been working with Andy to look at deep convective columns. And can we say something about them with the same kind of asymptotic techniques that we have here? And of course, for the picture that I had before, this would come handy in some sense. You could sort of synchronize narrower turrets of ups and downs. And so what the scalings that we look at here are the inner ones sketched here. So it's a 10 kilometer or scale height difference in the vertical. It is in the horizontal, the deep convective turrets are on the small scale. So one scale down from the pressure scale height, which would be roughly a kilometer characteristic length in the horizontal. And now, in the context of the embryo model for hurricanes, we were thinking of coupling these turrets with the mesoscale, which is H scale over epsilon, because on that scale what you can see is advection of planetary vorticity coming in. You see the Coriolis term, and then you can see how by updrafts, accumulated updrafts in many deep columns, you can pull in planetary vorticity and have it have a local vortex spin up on the mesoscale. It doesn't have to be the big scale yet. Right, and so what we did is we looked at the mesoscale outer scalings, and then the inner scalings for the turrets are 10 kilometers in the vertical and smaller scale in the horizontal. And the equations that we get are what one could call pressureless column equations. These are written down here for a barotropic background in the first place, where vertical accelerations are driven by buoyancy. Buoyancy again evolves because of source terms from latent heat and by the background stratification, or it moves in the background stratification. And then there is an interesting effect coming in the horizontal motion on the small scale, which could basically stir the column internally. You have a Coriolis term from the vertical motion coming up, from the horizontal flow in these scales. So that if you move upward strongly, you have a push in this direction, you can actually produce a dipole of vorticity inside of such a column. Otherwise, the turret flow is inelastic. Now, one option that one could go is to simplify here to axisymmetric case, in which case you can basically solve this part analytically and then have a turret structure that lives on its own and where buoyancy and source terms interact with possibly turbulent drag forms. Suppose we can construct such a closed column model, then we want to embed it into the large scale, the middle scale surrounding flow, and that turns out to then be something of what is called the WTG or weak temperature gradient type, where the effective source terms, accumulated source terms from the turrets that we get would drive vertical motions in the background stratification. The vertical motion then, by the anelastic constraint, generates horizontal inward velocities, negative divergences, and then due to the Coriolis effect coming in here, what you could see is you could begin to see spinning up of our on the Mesoscale. So that would be
if you have a Martinic vortex, does it meet the temperature gradient? It's not going to be in progress. Approximation.
Well, it has little to do with baroclinicity. That's not the cheat here. The slight cheat in these equations, as I have it actually on the slide, is at this point, because this model is as simple as it is only if you have a nearly barotropic slope.
Yeah.
But that's fair enough.
You're doing one version. We actually have a second version. That's a different setup than this version. It's a W. Anyway, I agree with Rupert. WTG has nothing to do with the Clinic or barotropic vortex background. It has to do with the small scale column equations Rupert wrote down on the first slide, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's
where it changes.
Right. So, actually, I conclude. I've given you a brief overview of the general approach, which we try to follow through with based on finding one single epsilon that's universal and building models for all sorts of phenomena based on a systematic approach from the compressible flow equations. We studied by matched asymptotics, concentrated vortices, found out that we can have cross-structure description, cross-structure evolution equations, and the interaction of the cross-structure with the tilt and the motion of the vortex. And we're on the way to construct multi-scale models to resolve maybe some of the open questions that remain in the build-up of such vortices and in the internal cross-structure.